It's time once again for Bad Radio Reports, spanning the globe to bring you everything you need to know to survive in our complex and ever-changing world. Ignore it, and you could die.
Not true.
And now, your Bad Radio Reports correspondents, Bob Sturm, Dan McDowell, and Donovan Lewis.
All right. Shorty.
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 Oh, no, you're supposed to rough there.
Oh, rough.
Woof.
All right.
Woof.
Bad Radio Reports today will deal with our field trip yesterday. Because we lead a charmed life, maybe not as charmed as Tom Grieve, but it's up there.
It's a existence of some privilege, it seems.
We had the opportunity to go to the set of the FX program, Sons of Anarchy. Sons of Anarchy, I consider to be a pretty good show. But the bar is very high for us, I think. You know, The Shield, I think, was top shelf. Sons of Anarchy, I consider to be just below that.
You scared me with pretty good. I think it's well above pretty good. I'm not saying it's
The
Shield.
It's a very good show, but it's not... Yeah, I guess, like I said, we raised that bar by going to the set of The Shield and really having good relationships with a lot of those guys over the years. So now I kind of put everything up to that level, but I shouldn't, because what we did yesterday was totally awesome.
I think you should rank them as okay, maybe Rescue Me, really good, and then TV Immortality.
Okay, TV, so it's a really good show.
TV Immortality is reserved for The Shield and The Wire and Sopranos. Maybe a few more.
Exactly, like Bonsai. Okay, so we got to go to the set. One of the guys over there, John Solberg, is a PR guy at FX. He's from Dallas, or he's from Fort Worth. Huge Rangers fan.
Is he a PR guy? Because everyone treats him like he runs the place.
He's like an executive now.
I think he's well above PR guy, bro.
He's like maybe vice president of.
I think he's a big deal. Just watching how the actors treat him.
They run over, they jump to his attention, yes.
Yeah, he's a very big deal.
He makes the motorcycle gang members quiver.
I don't want to downplay what he does. All I know is he set us up. He's from Fort Worth, big Ranger fan, big fan of the ticket.
Real big.
And he's helped us out many, many times in the past, and including yesterday when we showed up to the set. Actually, it was not exactly the FX set.
It's not, or
some not the
sound
FX
stage.
Studios.
No, it's a
It was like an
alley,
old warehouse.
It's a back alley of an industrial section of North Hollywood. You would never think to look there, would you?
No, not at all. And when we rolled
it's
up...
It's a residential, part industrial, part residential, because where we parked, there was, families and kids sitting outside.
Didn't that look like a scene from 24 when we rolled up? We're walking up to the studio, right? And a van pulls up, and the window goes down and says, "Hey, you guys from the ticket?" Look like they were going to throw us in the van and take off and kidnap us. So they were like, "Who's asking?"
Yeah, so they throw us in a van, and they were actually quite friendly. They
unmarked,
throw us in the van.
Unmarked gray van.
But we get in the van, and we go down the block, and we are taken to a sound or to a set that's actually on the street that's depicting Belfast, because this season the Sons are headed to Ireland, it appears, or some of them are.
Because Jax's baby was kidnapped at the end of season two.
And
by Irish, right?
The IRA.
Some
guys,
leprechauns?
I believe. And so...
Let's not pee on this segment just yet, okay?
So they have the set built up as if it's Belfast, and we show up, and it's crazy, because on one side of the street are all the director's chairs and the shade and the drinks and the wardrobe and everything. On the other side of the street is the director in his tent and the camera people, and there's a huge lift that has a giant shade over the scene, and just all of the TV things that go into a TV. And then the street itself, here goes a UPS truck, and here comes a station wagon with a family.
Yeah, here's a car booming, with the window down, basing.
Well, so, a UPS truck or an ill-timed horn a block away.
Oh, that's right. That's
causes
right.
them to have to stop things down and do the scene again.
That's why they got to do a lot of audio stuff in post-production, because there's all kinds of stuff like that going on.
Yeah, they're just on a normal street in Los Angeles, and you can...
But they shut it down. Like, they're going to record this scene that takes, like, a minute. And so they tell everybody, all right, places, and they have a cop on one end of the street and a cop on the other, and they... Or rent a cop, I don't know. I doubt they're employed by the city, but they shut down traffic.
I think it was Ponch and John, actually.
They shut down traffic right there, and then they roll the scene. Once he says cut... The guys, you know, they all got headsets, and they let the traffic go back. And
but if a plane flies by, they have to stop. And
which did happen.
And an actress will cuss the plane out.
Yeah, and much like our trip to the Shield 5 or 6 years ago, when we got to see them do a scene, we stood there for a good 90 minutes, and they did what amounts to probably 10 seconds of what you'll see in Episode 11.
But they got it recorded from a couple different angles.
They got it, yeah.
They got to get a close-up of Jax. They got... We got to meet Jax.
Yeah, cool. We got to meet short Charlie Hunnam, who, this is the theme of all of them, is you meet the sons, and on TV they're larger than life.
Oh, my gosh.
Big, strappy
dudes. I couldn't believe how small he ended up being.
I towered over Ron Perlman, which really rattled a lot of people on Twitter.
He's Hellboy.
He's short.
Yeah, like,
Bob, I want a pet Hellboy.
Bob is a foot taller, he's...
Have you ever seen Hellboy?
Has anyone seen it?
Yeah, sure.
Have you?
Mm-hmm.
You've seen it.
It came on HBO or something like that. I didn't see it in a theater or nothing.
He's never seen it.
Yeah.
Or all the way through.
Yeah. He's like from hell. He's a boy.
All right. See, why is Tom's mic on? He has not
so far,
contributed thus
got
far.
Nothing on him.
We're trying to tell a story. So the set, anyway, it was just awesome. So we walk up to, and John is like, hey, you want to meet the guy directing this week's episode? Apparently they have a rotation.
Which I think is common amongst television shows in general, is that they don't have the same director every episode. I don't understand how it works, but I believe that's the case.
Well, maybe the guy who's going to direct an episode needs a little time to get things ready, and he's getting his ducks in a row before it's his turn. I don't know.
Yeah.
But, so we go to meet the director, and I could tell right away who it was, and it was jarring to me. If you are a fan of Sons of Anarchy, the director... was the guy, or is the guy, he's still a character, I think he's just on the run.
Sure.
Was the white supremacist leader.
Yes.
Sean, the gray-haired guy, you know, with the hot daughter that ran and told Gemma that her baby was sick and she had to run back to the car. She's the one that set Gemma up for the gang raping. Anyway, he's the guy behind all of the evil, evil activities that they are taking part in. And then to have John turn around and introduce us to this guy, it was a little jarring that I was shaking hands with...
The white supremacist.
I felt like you don't share
his ideals.
No, I'm more
neo-Nazi.
In the Brotherhood. I'm more in the Sons. Why is Tom's mic on?
I don't know.
Okay, so...
Come on, let's have some fun.
We are having fun.
We got a lot of stuff to get through, Tom.
We're at the set of Sons of Anarchy. So we met Jax. And just like when we were on the set of The Shield, and maybe this is like everywhere in Hollywood, I don't know. But these people are bending over backwards to be nice and just treating you like a king. And maybe they know that we're part of the media and that we talk about their show and that they can use all the pub they can get. I don't know. I don't want to be too cynical about it, but these guys are really, really nice in welcoming us. And we met Opie.
Yes.
Ryan Hurst.
We did get it. Yeah, they were just hanging out at their trailer.
We not only met Ron Perlman. Ron Perlman's like, did you want to do a little interview with me?
Yeah.
So we sat in his air-conditioned trailer. We'll play that interview tomorrow. Excuse me.
Uh-oh.
We did about 10 or 15 minutes with him.
Absolutely.
We met a couple of the spares, the lower-level cast members that don't get too many scenes. The one guy who has his head tattooed.
Right.
Who was telling a funny little story about when he did, like, one episode of Lost.
I believe that was Juice.
He's the guy that beat up Saeed in season 2 in a Saeed flashback to when he was in Iraq. He's like, yeah, I got to kick the S out of him. And
well, he was talking about how he was on the plane with Ben. And Ben had no idea he was going to be a regular character. He had no idea how many episodes he was going
to
do.
Yeah, yeah, not in the show, but,
right.
But flying out to Hawaii,
right.
He was sitting next to Ben Linus, and Ben said,
I just signed up for
one episode, and it turns out that he ends up being just about the biggest character they got,
yeah.
This side of Jack and
Absolutely.
Kate.
So that was Juice. He was there with the guy who played the man in black in Lost.
Dude, that was
just sweet.
When
yeah.
I saw him, I was like, whoa.
Yeah,
you're the man in black.
His name is Titus. He's been in Deadwood. Titus, his last name starts with a W. Anyway, he's been in every show, and just to see those two guys just stand there.
His real name is Titus.
Yeah,
T-I-T-U-S.
Yeah, and Titus Welliver, I guess, is his name.
That's
he plays. He plays Jimmy in season 3. I believe he's one of the guys in Belfast. So those guys are hanging out. Then Opie and, the old Irish dude from Sons. They're just the main characters in the gang. They were hanging out, and we were just standing over there by their trailer. And like Dan said, very, very open and have not, you know, they got nothing to do but hang out with you. Oh, Chips. I'm sorry. Chips is his character name with the scar on his face, and he was the one smoking and helping Opie get back on his smoking habit.
Right, because of the show.
Titus?
Yeah.
No. The
Chips,
older guy.
The old Irish guy who was sitting there.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Next to Ryan Hurst, who plays Opie.
I think Opie had stopped smoking, but because of Sons of Anarchy, he said he started back again.
Yes.
In fact, the first drag he took was off of Chibs' cigarette.
Oh, right.
He grabbed his cigarette out of his hand and smoked it, and then he went inside and grabbed one out of his pack.
You know, it tasted funny.
It's really cool to get on the set and just to see everything. And they walk you through the old abandoned warehouse where all their sets are, and they show you, well, here's the hospital set, and then here's the clubhouse set, and we got to take pictures next to all the Sons of Anarchy landmarks. Sean, like the big boardroom meeting table.
With the carved
logo in the middle.
We touched it. We made some decisions. We took a vote on the show.
Yep.
About some things.
Did you grab the gavel?
There's also, of course, we had to recognize that if you don't ride, you don't vote edict at Sons of Anarchy. But it really, really a cool experience. And then
they also gave us the first 4 episodes of the season.
And don't think we're not going to watch them.
I didn't do it last night, though.
I was too tired, man. Too much time in the sun. It's nice and cool in California, but the sun is still the sun, right? And my little bald head got a little sunburn out there on the set, but it's all good. Then we got a chance to meet the creator of the whole thing, and it's Kurt Sutter. And Kurt Sutter, who also happens to be the husband of Katie Segal, you may know her as Peg Bundy. We know her as Gemma from Sons of Anarchy. And, I don't know, you just... When you're, I guess he's kind of a suit, Dan.
This guy?
No, I'm saying when you are the creator of a show, you expect, I don't know what I expect, but I don't expect the guy all tatted up and in jorts and long hair. And just,
yeah, he's got one of his arms is fully tattooed.
Got a sleeve.
He's creative, dude. He's not a suit. You're either creative or you're a suit.
Yeah,
he's
I just
he
wonder
is as far
how far.
From a suit as
no,
it gets.
I know, but I wonder how far up the ladder you go until you cross over. Like
this
like,
guy will like, never cross over.
Like Frito had to, and
he didn't have to.
And anyway, he said to us, "Hey, I'm going over to post production. Why don't you come hang out at my office and we'll talk for 10 or 15 minutes? And we want to play that interview coming up next."
Yeah, you know what? I'm thinking you're right that John Solberg is a bigger deal only because John set this up. And when we told the PR guy that, hey, John said we could have 10 minutes with the creator, he was like, whoa, really?
Yeah.
Oh, all right, I'll go ask. Like, seemed a little nervous about going to ask him. Like, this was not a common thing. Maybe a big magazine spread or something, you might get 10 minutes with the creator, but it just didn't seem like he expected a couple of Dallas radio spares to get the kind of service that we got. But he gave us 10 minutes, or he promoted 10 minutes. And we took like 25 or 30.
Well, let's play 10 solid minutes of our Kurt Sutter visit coming up next on The Ticket. Let's continue with our Sons of Anarchy big trip, good fun. And we had a chance to sit down with the creator of Sons of Anarchy himself, Kurt Sutter. So here's a little bit of that visit, Dan, unless you had some more you wanted to say prior to that.
Well, he's the creator. He worked on The Shield also. That's... need to know that.
Yeah.
And he's married to Katie Seagal, although we don't mention that at all in this interview. And it kind of starts out, we're just sitting there in his...
What's that like?
we're sitting there in his office, the four of us. He gave us a half hour of his time. And we started out by talking about, you know, just why a show about motorcycle gangs and stuff like that.
No, I've always had a sort of fascination with the subculture. I've been riding since my early 20s. I came cross country first time on a bike, and I had done a couple feature projects or been attached to a couple feature projects in the world prior to this show. So I was, you know, I've always had a fascination with the subculture, but, you know, I've never, you know, never really spent any time in the life. And you know, like writers do, I began the research when John Linson and I sat down together, who's my other executive producer, and they wanted to do something in TV, and we were, he had connections into this world, and introduced me to a lot of guys up in Northern California that were in the life, and I just started hanging out with them and sort of absorbing it, and ultimately from the time I spent with, you know, from spending time with them, came up with the idea for the show, and ultimately, you know, became Sons.
How did you go from the Shield to getting the green light to kind of do your own project? How does that happen?
You know, I was on my last the last season of the Shield when we sold this to FX. You know, we pitched this idea. I had it fleshed out fairly. You know, it's hard for me to work with a half of an idea, so before I even go and pitch stuff, I usually flush it out pretty thoroughly. And so we pitched it, and there was about three networks that wanted the show, and ultimately I landed at FX because I think, A, they got it, and more so than anyone else, and B, I knew they knew how to market shows towards male audiences. And also, you know, I've had a relationship with them now for 7 years from being on the Shield prior to, and so it just seemed like a good transition. And literally as I was finishing up that last season on the Shield, this began to move forward, and ironically my initial thought was that how it would play out was that the Shield would finish and then we would begin and take over the Shield time slot, but instead they ended up premiering us together, the last season of the Shield and the first season of Sun. So literally from the time they said, okay, we're going to make the series, I just had like a gun at my head, because it just got accelerated by about 9 months that I thought, you know, so that first season was really a crush to, you know, to get it up and on its feet, but ultimately the right decision. It was right for us to premiere with the Shield and have them sort of happen at the same time, and then the following season we took the Tuesday night 10 p.m. slot, which was the Shields.
How far ahead in a storyline do you create, like how far do you know right now, when did you know that the baby would be kidnapped, you know?
I know pretty much big arcs for a season, and I'll you know, my writers will know that, and if it's big emotional arcs, I'll always share that stuff with my actors, so I make sure everyone's on the same page emotionally. As far as a lot of the specific twists and turns that happen into episodes, a lot of that, unfortunately, I don't know until I actually get into my draft of the script. But in general, for big arcs, I'll usually know halfway through the season before where I want to go with the following season, so I can begin to lay some track to that. Like, I obviously knew this season would have a lot to do with finding the baby and Gem on the Lamb, and was able to, you know, I knew I was going to do this whole story arc that happened in Belfast, and so I was able to lay track to that. And I have a sense of what season four will be like if we're lucky enough to do a season four. You know, and I can now lay some track to that as I come into the back three or four episodes of this season.
And also referring to The Shield and many other shows we watch, how common is it, because it's, as you just referenced, you're not positive there will be a season four, and that's just how TV works, it's the nature of it. When guys are putting shows together, the uncertainty and the battle to stay on and relevant versus trying to get your whole story told and just the uncertainty of it all and everyone obviously wondering were the guys on Lost, for instance, kind of making it up as they were going until they had a final date. You know, just
or do you feel pressure maybe to, boy, I got to get something explosive in here to keep it. Are you going there?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
No, you know, I think all that's true, and I think, you know, it's always part of the creative challenge. You know, I have, like I've said, I have a sense of where I'd like the series to go in terms of broad strokes with my characters and kind of where I want to land. And, you know, I'm sure as, you know, in terms of the number of seasons, you know, I've referenced seven seasons, mainly because that's what we had on The Shield. And I know, quite frankly, the production model at that point becomes, it becomes very expensive to do the show. And that's really why The Shield ended, was because it becomes too expensive to produce. And to me, creatively, that was a good amount of time. And so my brain is sort of thinking in terms of, okay, if we are lucky enough to get seven seasons, how would I tell those stories? Now, if somebody came to me tomorrow and said, well, you know, you're gonna have to tell your whole story in four seasons, then obviously season four would be a little bit different. You know, I have a sense of where I would need to drop some of those bigger story points to get to the end. You know, you never know. I think everyone feels pretty good that our audience will hopefully return with us this year, and that we'll have the opportunity to tell the whole story. But you don't know.
I'm curious what you think about the whole finishing point of a series, and just, I mean, we feel like The Shield did as good a job as any series we can think of, but of course The Sopranos is looked at and examined, and you know, the end of Lost, and I'm just curious, what was that like trying to figure out how The Shield was going to get to where it went?
It's I think it's a fascination, because the truth is a lot of shows don't make it there, you know, and a lot of shows that continue to go on probably should have ended much sooner. You know, we always knew, or Sean always knew, ultimately where we needed to go with Vic in terms of that there had to be some comeuppance and some karmic payback for the things that he'd done. You know, quite frankly, a lot of it was waiting to see what The Sopranos did, what they did to Tony, in that, you know, were they going to kill Tony? Was he going to jail? Like, we wanted to make sure, you know, we were very cognizant of not wanting to echo that.
So if he had had the idea of Fade to Black, he wouldn't have done it.
Well, it's not
like
so much.
If he, you know,
well,
what I
that,
mean?
That's sort of a non-ending, and I think that's the point Chase was trying to make, that it doesn't end and then it does go on, and who's to say, you know, when the story ends? But in terms of you know what, where was, because that storyline was heading to a very dynamic ending, you know, with Tony literally sleeping with a, you know, with an automatic rifle and an assault rifle. You know, it was going to a very specific place, and we're like, well, what's going to happen here? So we were just cognizant of that. So, and it wasn't like that was going to dictate how we were going to tell our stories, but it may have dictated what direction we were going to go in, and ultimately we you know, we liked the idea that that, you know, jail or death would ultimately almost be too easy for Vic, and the notion that, you know, hell for Vic would literally be wearing a shirt and tie, sitting at a desk in a cubicle with a middle-aged you know, office manager sort of breathing down his neck, you know, and we loved the notion of that, and it was risky in that it's not a very explosive conclusion, but we felt like ultimately it was creatively A, the most organic and real, and B, probably the worst possible thing that could happen to Vic. He's lost his family, he's lost his balls, and he's lost his job, you know, and that to me was, you know, was the way to take this guy out.
Is that something the end? Is that something you constantly think about? And how often does it change?
I don't think it's something I constantly think about. I have, you know, I'm lucky now that it's still far enough away that as my story changes and my narrative takes different tweaks and stuff, I'm still heading in the right direction. So I'm not, it's not, I think that point will be much more valid, like season 5 or 6, when I'm getting closer to that point and I have to be really cognizant of, okay, this is where I need to go, you know, is it changing or am I getting there? But right now it's enough in the distance where I'm sort of still heading in the right direction.
All right, that's part of our visit with the great Kurt Sutter, the creator of the Sons of Anarchy and one of the main writers on The Shield as well. So talk about a guy who has some insight on two of our little television babies, Dan. There he is. That was very cool. And we got more with him that we'll play down the road because he's got some hot sports opinions on censorship and rules and just how a creator must work around naughty words and things
like
that.
Yeah, you know what? They have rules. Like, I kind of forget that. And I forgot it when we were on the set watching them film. And Donovan pointed out something that was going on. So, in the scene, and we won't see this till episode 9 or so, I think.
9 or 11? I believe it was 11.
Episode 11?
3-11 last night.
A girl walks down the stairs. They're in Ireland. A girl walks down the stairs. Jax walks over to her, meets her at the bottom, and then they talk. Well, they had to film... We talked about this earlier. They did this for 90 minutes, this one, less than 1 minute scene.
Yeah.
And in this scene, they have to take some different camera angles and get Jax's reaction to something. So they're just filming Jax for a time. Well, I forgot that we were watching an FX show because during this, she would say something to him and use a profanity, and every time it was something different. One time it was the F word, then it was the C word, then it was, I mean,
she was... word, she used every one you could think of.
She was going all out.
Right.
Holds barred. And then we were just listening and thinking, oh, okay, cool, scene. But then later, you know, when we were talking about the censorship and that he has standards and practices up his rear sometimes on what they can or cannot show, I guess they were just filming for a Jax reaction look. And so every time she was trying to say something different, in order to elicit more of a, like, if he's expecting the F word, well, when you come at him with the C word, then he might...
throw a change up at him.
You know what I mean? Then
sure.
then that makes for a more realistic or a different interesting reaction of his on camera, which you'll never hear what she said.
Uh-huh.
You'll just see his reaction.
See his
and who
eyes
knows if
start.
They yeah. dub in her saying something else. I don't know. That it's fascinating stuff. It's I don't know if... I would want to trade lives because I think it's a...
They
it's tedious.
It's a tedious existence.
Yes, it is.
You're called there. You got to get there at 8 in the morning. Then you're there till 8 at night sometimes, and you're just...
Well, that's not even...
might work for a minute in an hour, you know?
And that's not even as tedious. And that's not even as tedious. TV is not nearly as tedious as feature film shooting.
Well, funny you say that because we talked with Ron Perlman about that, and we'll play that for you on the show tomorrow. So, many
like one of the big... points that many people told us is that they shoot like
seven or eight pages a day.
Yeah.
And in the movies, they shoot one page a day.
Page and a half. Crazy.
So they really can take their time to get it right, whereas they got a time deadline, and even if they don't get it perfect, if you're in TV, well, let's get it moving.
Well, go Sam Crow. That was fun, and like we said, we have plenty more for another day.
Guilty as charged.
Including tomorrow.
We were at the set of Sons of Anarchy the other day, the FX program, which
lucky.
We are in love with. And we got to sit down with Clay Morrow, who is really named Ron Perlman. And we're in his trailer. You're going to hear air conditioning in the background. It's kind of a weird setup, but it was cool that he's like, hey, guys, you want to talk to me? You mind if I smoke my cigar? We were like, yes and no, in that order.
And the PR guy... doesn't even join us, so it's just us and him in his trailer with his little dog, and it's a little weird, but kind of cool all at the same time. Didn't you even kind of wonder what the Superstar trailer was like? Now, this isn't Tom Cruise on the set of Mission Impossible trailer, but this is the co-lead of the show.
Yeah, he had the biggest trailer of anyone, right?
And guess what? It's just a trailer. In fact, the TV is the size of your laptop TV, and there's a little microwave.
But heavily air-conditioned,
yeah.
A nice couch to lay on and take a nap.
Yeah, you don't have,
don't have to
share toilets with other members of the Sam Crow.
Right.
But it's just a trailer.
All right, so here we go. Stop it if you must. Maybe we'll stop and reset once in a while, because I don't know if we were in radio mode so much as just kind of sitting around talking to Ron Perlman mode.
This is the great Ron Perlman now. Here in his luxurious trailer. You got one of the bigger trailers, I suppose, bigger than Opie's.
Yeah, this is as big as it gets around here. You know, most of the other guys got to go outside to change their mind.
How have things changed on the Suns?
Vaudeville there for you.
I'm sorry.
He wasn't listening.
This is clearly why Vaudeville is dead. What was the question?
I was going to lead into how have things changed for you and such with Suns. We know the, in fact, we're probably common. We jumped in after the first season had already aired, and we heard so much buzz about it, and then got the DVDs and loved it, and then watched last season. All you know, now we're trying to get ahead of the game by watching them ahead of time. It's just wonder what you feel as far as reaction is concerned. How much bigger did things get after year one?
Well, considering that, you know, after, like, nearly 40 years in the movie business, I'm wired for failure. Like, I, you know, everything I ever thought was going to be good just fell on its face. And so I expect failure every time out now. You know, any positive reaction to anything is like, holy shit, really? Uh-huh. Really? So, yeah, I'm delighted. I mean, you know, I mean, I'm one of those guys, you know.
So not that you're a pessimist, but you set the bar low so that you feel better when...
I'm just always wrong, is basically what the deal is.
Okay,
if I like something, it's surefire to fall on its face.
You've been in something that you thought this is going to be awesome, and
yeah,
it's been horrible.
Thing after thing. I've been, you know, modest successes, critical successes, but, you know, this is, I mean, you know, this is like numbers, which I'm not used to, you know, having in the plus column. You know, numbers don't lie.
No?
I'm not jiving you. Numbers, they don't lie, man. A number is a number, you know, it's finite.
So going in, though, when you first got this role, did you think this could take off, or you just had your negative attitude towards the possibility of that?
No, I liked it, so I figured this can't work.
Okay.
I liked it from the get-go, you know, and no, I mean, like I said, I'm serious. I'm wired for failure. I don't even know how to cope with success, but I'm riding it, you know. Enough medication, you can get through anything.
So, what do you have to do to get ready for a role like this in terms of when they tell you, all right, here's what we're thinking for your role, or however one goes about getting that? Then are you trying to embed yourself and figure out what is authentic and what's folklore and all that sort of thing? This is not a typical role in Hollywood, right?
No, I can't recall when the MC world has been explored to this degree. I guess there's been, you know, a movie here and a movie there. Most of them were pretty dismissible. Most of them were pretty one-dimensional. But Kurt was determined to examine the MC world, but not just examine it, but try to get it right. You know, try to get a very nuanced, very multi-dimensional look at the dynamics of the day-to-day and the family aspect of the fact that, you know, this whole thing is established to be around the guys and women you want to be around and, you know, keep everything else out. So it's each of these MCs are kind of like their own sovereign nations, including, you know, national interests and borderlines, border turfs, and, you know, things that they fight for and defend, and just so that they can live in a manner of their own conception rather than on some, you know, according to some societal, you know, group of mores and values.
So as you guys portray the MC, this might sound like a really dumb question, but that's authentic. You feel like groups like the Sons of Anarchy are out there today and that sort of, I mean, this is real and out there. I mean, we're watching the show and we love it, but we don't know where the lines are and what's real and what's out there that we don't know about, you know?
No, I mean, I it's a guess for me as well,
okay.
Because I'm not, you know, I'm not a rider, much less a member of a motorcycle club. But I can tell you that the response from the real deal guys has been just overwhelmingly positive, which means that, and there was a great deal of skepticism going into this, especially the Hell's Angels. You know, they don't like being exposed. They don't like being exploited.
Right.
They want to be kept to themselves and live their lives and, you know, be off the grid. That's, you know, the typical outlaw kind of point of view. They've welcomed us in overwhelmingly positive ways, and they have not had anything really negative to say about where we've taken these stories and how we've moved through them as individuals. Now, you know, most of the work is done for me by Kurt, because he's the one who created the world, he's the one that set the parameters, he's the one that set up the hierarchy, the chain of command, and all of the nuances therein. And so a lot of it is just basically learning the lines and saying the lines. But there was some research, because it was a world that was totally foreign to me. There was some reading that I felt obligated to do. There was, you know, because the mandate was to just get it right and get as close to how it might be in a very non-exploitative way as we possibly could.
This is radio personality Dan McDowell interrupting this interview to tell you this is Clay Morrow, Ron Perlman in real life, but this is our interview we did a couple days ago on the set of Sons of Anarchy. Like that reset?
Love it.
So I'm just saying that we're playing the interview, and I want to tell you who we're talking to. It's Ron Perlman.
Did you consciously notice that they all say MCs instead of motorcycle gangs? It's motorcycle clubs.
Yes, and he goes MC, and then I noticed you.
Oh yeah,
the chameleon that you are, just kind of blended right in.
And I tried to adapt to it.
You're one of the sons, or you could be.
I'd love to.
Right now, you're more of a prospect.
In a very non-exploitative way. As we possibly could. I think probably our most cherished reviews were from the real MC guys, you know, rather than from TV critics.
Are you, all of you guys seasoned riders, or did you have to pick up the art of just riding a motorcycle for the show?
I think only a fraction of us rode before that. We got hired to do the show. I never rode. I was one of the ones that didn't ride. But most of the guys took to it. I'm the one that didn't.
Really?
Yeah. I basically, you know, I'm still terrified of the bike. I'm not happy on the bike. I am intimidated by the bike. I'm intimidated by its size, by its exposure, by its power. And first year, you hardly saw my character. Where it was me doing it. Second year was a little bit more. The third year, it's pretty much all me. So I'm saying, all right, I guess we're going to be here for a while. I better at least act like, you know, like I give a
Well, they were even telling us out there in the alley that sometimes the scenes where you guys may all ride in together into the club or whatever.
No, that's not about
that. It looks really cool on the shot, but when you're actually performing it,
that just point out that's when I had a little cough. That's it, nothing big. But he was smoking a cigar, And then he's apologizing for smoke, and I'm like, no, 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 that's...
the head cough right there.
I don't
there.
Care about the smoke. It was just a little cough, clearing my throat kind of thing, and...
thought perhaps he had a newborn baby in the trailer, and he should be considerate.
Yeah, well, no, I'm sure a lot of people do find that repulsive or something. I don't mind a... in fact, cigar smoke, to me, doesn't bother me as much as cigarette smoke.
I'm with you.
Agree.
Cigar smoke is good, but I told Ron Perlman, trust him. That smoke is not bothering him. He's used to it.
I'm on board. Go for it.
It looks really cool on the shot, but when you're actually performing it, you may sit there for half an hour and then go 20 feet and try to do it again and again and again, so it's not quite the glamorous Sunday afternoon ride that it looks like on TV.
Right. Well, that's true of everything you do.
That's just TV, right?
That's just movies and television, you know. It's a, you know, you're creating an illusion, you know. You're creating an illusion, and you're trying to nail a moment, you know, that's made up by somebody, you know. So, yeah, that's what it is.
What do you prefer, movies or TV?
I like television for the fact that, you know, when you fall in love with a character like I have with Clay, you know, the luxury of seeing as many facets of him as you get to see in a long-running television show. You know, you do a movie, it's 2 hours long, takes a few months to shoot, you know, and you're done with him. And you get one crack at it. But I there's something about being on a set of a movie that is, for me, the most exciting place to be for a performer. I'm a movie freak.
So personally, you like developing your character, but professionally, I guess, just the fun of the movie is, you're saying like that's more of a fun time?
Yeah, I mean, there's a slightly different approach to movies, especially bigger movies. You know, you're usually shooting a page, page and a half, 2 pages a day. So a great deal of care and time is given to what we're doing. You're working with a great deal of resources, if it's a big movie, money, talent, people who are, you know, in a class by themselves. In every department, there's something amazingly exciting and humbling about being in the presence of all that greatness and all of whom are collaborating for a single vision. So I always thought that movie making was the greatest art form ever invented, and you know, I'm still thrilled every time I walk on a movie set and meet the crew and meet the cast and get ready to all dive into this venture together. And you know, it's a finite amount of time. You know, you're always rising to some occasion, so you're always challenged, you're always engaged, and it's a pretty cool way of making a living.
When you do something like Robot Chicken or something, what's that like? Is that like a little studio, or do you get to watch what you're voicing?
No, the way it works in animation is you voice it, and then they take the recordings of the actors, and then they animate to the voices.
Oh, okay.
And then they come back to you after it's all animated, and occasionally they ask you to clean up something here or there. But the animation is done to the voices, so the voice is the very first phase. And that's my phone. I like the Latin. I like the Latin sound a lot.
You know?
Anybody want to dance?
Yeah, he's the dancer.
Are you picking that up?
No, I don't
need to answer it. I'm with everybody I want to speak to right now.
Okay.
Yeah.
We appreciate
you know
that.
I'm
saying? That's awesome.
Who's this?
That's Nigel. For those of you on radio, I have a Jack Russell Terrier, my constant companion. He's with me all over the world. And he's a 6.5-year-old Jack Russell Terrier. Black, mostly white.
Very good description.
That's very awesome. Well, listen, we really appreciate your time. Love the show. We absolutely are.
It's really cool to spend time with you guys. And thanks for taking an interest.
Hey, let me ask you, could you do one more thing? I'll ask you if you could. It's a liner for our radio show where we'd like you to identify yourself. And then say, I never listened to Bob and Dan on the Ticket.
Hi, this is Ron Perlman, and one thing you'll never catch me doing is listening to Bob and Dan on the Ticket. Ever.
Awesome.
Well done.
Thank you, sir.
really appreciate it.
Thank you, Nigel. Great time.
Sorry I rewrote it, man. But
yeah. And there he goes.
Thank you very much.
Ron Perlman.
A lot shorter than you think.
Yeah. I could post him up for sure.
I want to pet him.
All right. What's that?
I want to pet him.
Oh,
he's so cute.
I think you'd find him to be a giant, Groobs.
I don't know.
You can probably use that phrase, what you just said, and it's kind of a blanket thing, couldn't you? No matter who you're talking about?
Pretty much.
With our cute
maybe Mini-Me. He'd pet me.
At times we put Groobs in that little back harness like Yoda in Empire Strikes Back when Luke is working out on Dagobah. So just picture that for a little
Or like minute. Carlos.
But you think about that.
That's the one I like.
Don't
I
you
like
sometimes think
Bjorn.
About your spare actor or, you know, your guy you kind of know? And, like, he led off that interview with just how he's just not wired to expect success because nothing good has happened to him ever. He's 60, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, and you
so
look at his IMDb page.
Away.
You look at his IMDb page, Dan, and it's got, I don't know, 150 jobs he's been on.
But nothing is ever really, like, this is the biggest thing he's ever been in, he says.
I guess.
Like, getting numbers
does he picture this greater than his cinematic masterpieces?
Like Hellboy?
Exactly. Oh, well, in the sequel.
Right, Hellboy 2.
And that sequel? Didn't it have a 3
I don't think so.
Oh.
Anyway, very cool of him and Kurt Sutter and the Sons of Anarchy gang for letting us come hang out with them.
Motorcycle Club, sir.
Motorcycle Club.
Dude.
The FX gang.
What's wrong with you?
Motorcycle Club.
Boy, they would burn that tattoo off your back if they heard you say that.
Oh, ouch.
Yeah,
212.
Jack Wagon!